Thank you, Jill. See, I should be on the... Turn it on. Is that working? Great. So, thank you, Jill. Yeah, it's 20 years, by the way. I'm proud of every one of them. And I also don't dye my hair because I'm also proud of every one of the gray hairs. I've earned them all. So, there we go. We're going to be talking about Every Child Ready to Read. And the easiest way for me to do this was to sort of walk you through a workshop that I would do for parents. But I want to do a little introduction for those of you who aren't familiar, first, to my relationship to this and the National Library Service. About 10 years ago, when you last updated your standards, I went to the meeting, and I actually brought some other ALSC members, and that's the Association for Library Service to Children, because it was always disturbing to me that you didn't buy in the area of early literacy at that time, prior to that. There weren't twin vision books in the library. There weren't books that blind parents could share with their sighted children or sighted children could share with their blind parents. And I knew that we were missing this whole crucial thing. So I was there for the public comments for that, for those guidelines. I was there for the public comments for the next guidelines, and I've been there for the public comments for the new guidelines. So I'm just thrilled to see early literacy in them, and I think this is going to usher in a whole new era for Braille literacy in this country. So that's on the NLS and Braille side. On the broader side, early literacy is something that as a country that we're just beginning to pay attention to. And the library world came a little late to this in general, but not too late. In 2004, Every Child Ready to Read was launched to the public. And this was a research-based approach to early literacy in libraries, and it was a paradigm shift for us. We moved from assuming that we could do a story hour once a week for young children, or even once a month, and that would help their literacy skills. When we studied it, we found out that just wasn't true. We needed parents to be doing these things in the home because we didn't see them enough. And so they did. They reviewed the research. They looked at everything, and they came up with a model of 6 early literacy skills. And we're going to circle back to that in a minute. Then, because they're really amazing and the project is well-funded, they took another look after it had been in place for a while in 2010, and they found out a couple of things, one of which was that people were having trouble with the 6 early literacy skills. It was a little complicated for librarians and for parents. So they developed a new model of 5 early literacy practices. But they kept the most important part, which was the librarian's role is to support and teach parents and caregivers how to support early literacy in their children. And I just want to mention that this is, it's proprietary. You can buy the manual and the software and all that stuff from PLA and the Association for Library Service to Children. It's their joint project. Otherwise, I would, as I normally do, just put this up for you guys to use. But you do need to go through that process first. Sorry about that. That being said, I've heavily mutilated it. It was a very, very good system, and it worked well for everybody, but they just didn't talk about how it worked for kids with disabilities. And that's who I serve, children and teens with disabilities. So, and I had been doing literacy workshops, early literacy workshops for parents for 15 years, for 10 years before this came out in the first place. So I kind of combined the things. And then it's when I got the request from a couple of preschools and early intervention programs in the New York City area to do it for their parents, I tweaked it again. Those programs have now mostly closed. I think, Jill, correct me if we're wrong, we're down to basically 2 early intervention programs, Helen Keller and New York Institute in the Bronx. Yeah. So we're down from 5 to 2, and a lot of our little guys aren't getting the same services that they used to get. So I haven't actually done this in a while, so I had to update it for you guys. But I think and now I'm ready to go when they call. So what's different about, in particular, how we're going to use Every Child Ready to Read for the parents of children who are blind and with low vision? Well, I had to address those issues directly. I added tips and resources that are different from the Every Child Ready to Read. And I wanted to make sure that the parents saw their children in the PowerPoint and in the whole process. So I made sure that I included pictures of children who are blind. And the picture there on the screen is a little guy reading with a whole bunch of Twin Vision books around him with graphic illustrations reading them. I also wanted to be a little more diverse. Every Child Ready to Read was very good about being diverse about the people they portrayed. But they didn't have a lot of older caregivers, and they didn't have a lot of ethnically or racially mixed families. And also, because they were really focused on families, they didn't have pictures from schools and preschools. But hopefully our kids are in those early intervention programs and those preschool special education programs and getting services from a very early age. So I included those pictures. So now we're going from what I added to basically what is it. So this is from the next... slides are from the program itself, adapted by me. So first they talk about how reading is important and how easy it is to get kids ready to read. And the two pictures there of on the top is what I assume is a parent-child, again, reading a book with, a print book with Braille overlays. And on the bottom picture is a little girl, a little older, probably 6 or 7, in a wheelchair, playing with or reading a fabric Braille book with lots of texture. I have, by the way, all the citations for the photographs. If anybody wants them afterwards, please ask. So then I wanted to... Every Child Ready to Read talks about you are your child's first teacher, that your child learns from you. And then they say you're your child's first teacher. I took that out because in a lot of the cultures that I work with, teachers are an authority figure. They're not necessarily well-loved. They're often feared. It's a very different approach to education. So I didn't want to put that sort of negative overlay on this. So what I changed that to is your child learns from you. You know your child best. That's from Every Child Ready to Read. And children learn best by doing. So I really, one of the things I often say to families is, please don't use flashcards and drills, especially not with young children, because it really just creates negative associations and tension with early literacy and doesn't help them learn. Children learn by doing, and they learn in context, and they learn socially. And the two pictures there is about an 18-month-old playing with the Braille alphabet that's taller than he is. It's on a wooden board with the cells raised, and then it has tactile illustrations. And then another of what I assume to be a parent and child reading together for another Twin Vision book, young child. So the 6 early literacy skills were, again, research-based. So these are the things that any child who is learning to read needs to know. They need print motivation, and that's a fancy way of saying they need to want to learn to read. They need a vocabulary. They need to know the names of things. They need to know that print is important. In this case, they need to know that print and Braille are important and what they do. They need letter knowledge. They need to know the letters. They need to know the alphabet. They need to know it in order. They need narrative skills. So what's that? Anybody here ever heard a child tell a story? So what happens? You start over here, you swirl up and around in the air, you circle back, you go past the beginning, then you shoot past the end, then you come back to the middle. There's no structure to it. There's no beginning, middle, and end. And that's what a narrative skill is, an understanding that a story has those parts. And they need phonological awareness. It took me 7 months to learn to say that word. And that means they need to be able to hear the smaller sounds in words. That's so important that we teach it visually and tactily to deaf children, because you cannot decode words in English unless you can understand that they're made up of smaller sounds. So this is what we were teaching parents with the original early child, Every Child Ready to Read. The second version dropped that. I keep it in mind because, out of respect for the parents, I think they can understand this. But also because the other things make more sense when you talk about it this way, I think. So that's That's an important part, and throughout my workshop, I circle back to it when I do it for parents. We have a picture there of an African-American family reading a book, and at the top and at the bottom is another Twin Vision book. It's That's Not My Bear. Anybody know that book? It's got, again, tactile illustrations. It's got a little bear that you can move from pocket to pocket. It's a lovely book. Tends to get chewed a lot, but that's okay. At least the teeth marks are indentations and not bumps. Okay, so as I said earlier, we moved from that model to five early literacy practices. And those early literacy practices are talking, singing, reading, writing, and playing. And our pictures there are, again, families reading, or adults and children reading together, blind children reading twin vision books, and in the lower one, we have an older adult reading to her, to a young child. So I talk about these in terms of building those early literacy skills that we just saw, so that there's actually a reason for this, because parents really don't understand how playing can help their child learn to read, or how scribbling on the wall can help their child learn to read. I, by the way, tell them that they ought to put butcher block paper on the wall, and then let their children scribble on it. So the first one is talking. Children learn about language by listening to parents talk and by joining in the conversations. It's really basic, but this room is diverse enough that I bet a bunch of you grew up with the idea that children should be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't subscribe to that anymore. But again, I'm from Brooklyn, and I teach this workshop in Brooklyn, and a lot of our families still do. They're from very traditional cultures where that's an important part. So that's sometimes something we have to struggle with. Again, two pictures of an adult, and in one case a little baby talking, and the other an adult and probably a 6 or 7 year old child sitting on the stairs outside a building talking. So talking to a baby. Well, what do you say to a baby? By the way, is somebody going to give me a 10-minute warning?
Again, yeah.
Yeah? Okay, thank you. So what do you say to a baby? Well, goo goo gaga is a good place to start. Ma, 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 da, 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 da. Those are great places to start. But just talk. It doesn't matter what you say to a baby. When my son was born and spent 3 weeks in the neonatal ICU, I read him his medical chart. Doctor wasn't happy about that. He told me I was going to upset the baby. He's 3 days old, still hasn't reached his gestational age, and I think it's okay. Telephone book, whatever you're reading, read it to the baby. We don't have telephone books anymore. Read your phone. Read your tweets. Whatever you're doing. Self-talk. And this is really important, and it's particularly important for our guys with low vision and who are blind. Talk about what you're doing. Give names to the things you're doing. Explain what you're doing, because they don't know. Young children who aren't blind, they can see what you're doing, but they don't know what you're doing. They don't have words for it. And kids who are blind and with low vision, they can't see it. So unless you're describing what's going on, their world is very limited, right? Then we, as they get older, we want to do things like add a word. So they say wawa, and you say want wawa. You actually say want water. But we don't correct them. We just go with what they want. And then, again, it gets more and more complicated as it gets older. But the other thing that's really important is when you talk to a child, you want to engage the child. So you're not just doing self-talk and sort of blathering on like an idiot, which is fine. It's really important to do that. But you're talking to them, too. So with a little baby, you go up to them and say, hi, how are you this morning for you, little Kathy? Mm-hmm. And you asked a question, so you need to wait to give that baby a chance to respond, even if it's 2 weeks old, 3 weeks old, 6 months old. Are they going to respond? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Are they going to respond verbally? Probably not, right? But they're going to point, they're going to smile, they're going to laugh, they're going to go, ooh, you know. So, and we need to respond to that. And again, you know, putting a lot of inflection in your voice and sort of making it more dramatic helps get across the feelings behind what you're saying when they can't be picked up from visual cues. singing. Well, singing is a natural way to learn about language, and children will enjoy your singing. So you're going to hear a lot about my son today. Everybody in Brooklyn has heard a lot about my son. I sang to him all the time. And he had a lot, in addition to his first hospitalization, he had a lot of other hospitalizations, and you can't carry enough books. So we sang a lot. One time after his surgery, I sang the entire book of from Fiddler on the Roof. He also heard The Sound of Music and a bunch of other things, too. So every song I ever heard or learned and a bunch that I made up in a variety of languages, he heard those at one point or another. And as he got older, he started to sing. Oh, my God. It was painful. I can't tell you. It was, that child was awful. But, you know, he enjoyed it, so we encouraged him. Let's flip ahead to third grade, when everybody in his school was tested for chorus. Well, turns out my son, my 8-year-old son, had perfect pitch. So I was the one who couldn't sing. But he has been in a chorus, choir, or a cappella group since third grade. He loves to sing. He's in college, when he needed extra money, my Jewish son would go sing at churches as a soloist. And he works full-time, he's in graduate school, and he's still singing. So why am I telling you this, besides to embarrass myself, is because you can't hurt kids by singing badly to them. So no matter how badly you sing, you still need to sing to your children, because that's an important way for them to learn. And also, by the way, it's not bad for me to embarrass myself with a group of parents, because I come in as the expert. Like, I'm not likely to wear a suit with a group of parents, but I'm going to dress nice. And sometimes that's very intimidating, and I tend to be affiliated or associated with the school or whatever else, and they know they can't do what I do because I've got a master's degree. But I know they can do what I do. So that kind of, telling stories about myself and my son and embarrassing myself is a way for me to get rid of that barrier, that professional barrier, the racial barrier often, the language barrier that's there between me and the economic barrier. I do this a lot at homeless shelters. Between me and the families I'm working with. If they can laugh with me, they can listen to me. So we've talked about talking and singing, and now we're going to talk about reading. And this is what everybody's waiting for, right? Because you said you were going to talk about our kids learning to read. Okay, so yeah, I am. Reading together with your child is the single most important thing you can do to help your child learn to read. And you can say that over and over and over again, but it's true. This is where I throw in, don't play with the, don't use the flashcards, don't do drills. For our kids, we need to particularly pay attention to borrowing, making, and reading tactile books and braille books, twin vision books, books with large print, books with clear print. There's a lot of children's books out there with large print because we just do that, but often it's superimposed on the graphic background or a picture or an illustration, which makes it completely inaccessible for our kids. This is where I talk about NFB, Braille Reading Club, Iway Newsletter, Dots for Braille Literacy. Even though they're not current, their stuff is archived, and it's very, very good. So I want to give kids the support, and this is where I try and introduce them to Jill, at least remotely, and the Andrew Haskell Library. The two pictures on this page are an African-American man and about a 2-year-old child, and she's holding Fox and Socks, the Dr. Seuss book that's brailled, and it's got a little bear with it. And then the bottom picture is two families of East Asian descent, and they're also two people of East Asian descent, and he's the mother is holding the child, and he's got a homemade book in his lap. That has braille, raised letters, and graphic illustrations, tactile illustrations. And by the way, in each of the slides, there's a stylized figure of a man, of a person holding a star, and that's the logo from the Every Child Ready to Read. That's why it's in all the slides that they did. And sometimes it has text. This one says, shared reading is the best way to help your child get ready to read. And we know this, and we can cite studies, and I'll do that for the parents, but I'm not going to do it from you because I'm hoping you'll trust me. If you want the studies, I can refer you to them later. Writing. And this is a particularly hard one for kids who are blind and kids with low vision. because it's just not as simple as picking up a crayon and scribbling on a piece of paper. It can be as simple as picking up a crayon and scribbling on a piece of paper if you have that piece of paper on top of a Lego board or mesh, wire mesh, and if when you rub it with the crayon, you get some texture with it. But all those stages, the things that kids do in order to learn to write, scribbling, drawing pictures, writing their name, and then writing words, writing letters, and then writing words, our kids have to do too, but they're going to do it in a different way. So they're going to do it as that little baby. I mean, that child can't, in the first picture there, can't be more than 18 months old or maybe 2 years old with a Braille writer, pushing the little buttons on a Braille writer, right? And then that the Lego and the, under scribbling counts, you see the Lego with the paper on top of it and the crayon. Next, that's just a bunch of collage materials, peanut butter and other things. And that's, for some of our kids, that's the equivalent of scribbling. So they've got some peanut butter on a tray, an apple, and some rice, I think. And he's just manipulating it, playing with it with his fingers. And that looks to be about a 2 to 3 year old child. Assistive technology is important, and you've got to do it early. Right? You can't wait until a child is 5 years old when you're sure they're going to be comfortable and safe with the computer to give them assistive technology, because it's important for their early literacy skills, particularly for their writing skills. So we need to connect our families to the, obviously to the National Library Service, but also to your assistive technology centers in your states. And word writing. And lots of, there's all kinds of ways to push this in. Those are individual Braille cells. Those are actually key fobs. And for our younger kids, under the age of 3, we need to be careful about what we're giving them for this kind of stuff, but Braille blocks, because of choking hazards. If you can push the dots out, then it's a choking hazard. But there's all kinds of commercial products, even from Uncle Goose, it's one of my favorites, letter blocks, the traditional letter blocks with Braille cells on them for each letter as well. So our kids need to be encouraged to write their name, create and discuss art with them, however you do that. Scribe for the child if they want to tell a story, write it down and Braille it and read it back to them. Three-dimensional stickers, even googly eyes will work for them to kind of scribble with Braille. But making all those materials available to our kids and encouraging parents to make them available. Then the last of our early literacy projects, next slide, is playing. Can't say enough about playing, but how I convince parents that playing is important is I tell them about the study that says that if children play with blocks for 20 minutes a day, they, excuse me, they read a full grade level higher than their peers. Full grade level higher, just by playing with blocks. So why is that? Okay, normally I have some blocks or something to hold that I don't have a lot of faith in this. So they're going to build, right? And they're going to put this here. That didn't work. So they're going to try it again. Ooh, that didn't work either. Try it again. Oh, that worked. So let's try it again. That kind of worked. Okay, so what are we learning here? We're learning trial and error. We're learning resilience, to try again when something has failed, right? We're learning cause and effect. We're learning basic physics. But mostly we're learning problem solving. And that's the basis for all further learning, coming against a barrier and then being able to keep going and go past it. Problem solving and resilience. All of that from playing with blocks or a water bottle or paper cups. And the basic physics part, I like that. Literacy is based on language, and language is based on experience. And where a lot of our kids who are blind and with low vision, and kids in general who have disabilities, struggle with learning is through that lack of experience, right? Because we protect them. And let's be honest, we often overprotect them. And speaking as the parent of a child with multiple disabilities, I can tell you, that's the easiest thing to do. And that's what you feel like you really, that's the imperative as a parent. It doesn't work, because our kids don't learn about the world. If we keep them all coddled in their playpens, they're not exploring the world. They don't know what a couch is. They don't know what a door is, if they can't crawl and experiment with it. We can create safe spaces in our homes and our libraries that our kids can explore. And we need to encourage them to explore that, because if they can't see it, they're not necessarily going to go to it. So we need to have a musical toy over here, right? We need to have a path with lots of different texture, just kind of going around, things for them to explore nearby that are going to encourage them to take the next step. And that's really hard for our parents because it involves letting go, because it brings us up against our greatest fears. But if they're going to navigate the world as adults, they need to navigate the world as babies. And they need those experiences to build language, right? So literacy is language, is experience building language, building literacy. In our schools in New York, they are very late to institute orientation and mobility training and travel training. And that's something I'd really like them to see them do earlier, because again, that's part of exploring the world and experience it. When you're working with parents when they're in preschool, these are the kinds of things that need to be on an early intervention and a preschool IEP, an IFSP for early intervention and an IEP for preschool. Does everybody know what I'm talking about in early intervention and preschool special ed? Okay. And they need to play with things other than visual interest. It needs to have sound interest. There needs to be a lot of high contrast. Here you see kids playing on a light table that is in a preschool setting, but you can do similar things at home. And those, the other picture there is those are the Uncle Goose blocks with the Braille cells on them and the raised letters. But again, I can't stress this enough. We need to create safe and engaging play spaces for our kids so they can explore on their own, so they can learn on their own, so that they can function as adults later on. I'm talking about 3-week-old babies, 4-week-old babies, 6-week-old babies here. Right. Reading aloud, use the language you know best. This is another stumbling block for our families in Brooklyn. They speak so many languages, and all of them want their children to learn English. So they try and talk to their children in English. And a lot of educators for many years told them that. We know now that that's wrong. Children need language. It doesn't matter what language, they need language. Once they've developed the capacity for language, it can be transferred to other languages. But if they are slow to develop that language, they're going to struggle for the rest of their lives. So if what I get from parents is, I don't read to my child because I don't read English and I want him to learn English. Well, it's okay. Read to him in Spanish or Russian or Chinese. Read to him in Creole. Doesn't matter. And one of the pictures there is one of the very few books in Spanish commercially available with the Braille overlay. My clothes, mi ropa. And the other picture is, I have no idea what that is. I know it's not a children's book. It's in Chinese. And it's also Braille. And I couldn't find a picture of a Chinese language children's book with Braille. And that's a problem. So, and then there's the Very Hungry Caterpillar down there too, which also has Braille overlays, and that's also in Chinese. Oh, but it's not commercially available. It was adapted. So, the way I explain this to parents is by talking about brain development neurons and how we need the paths in the children need the paths in their brains to be created. Once those paths are created, the truck that runs across it can, the truck that runs across it can be in any language, but it needs that road to drive across. I do other things too, but that's the one that came to mind today. And by the way, bilingual adults are more employable than monolingual adults. So if your child grows up and is fluent in Chinese and English, or Russian and English, or Hindu and English, they're going to earn more money. So then, this is slightly off script from Every Child Ready to Read 2, but refers back to Every Child Ready to Read 1, in terms of tips for reading out loud. We need to focus on what we're reading. We need for 5 minutes a day to turn off the cell phones, turn off the television, turn off the radio, and sit and read with your child. Doesn't matter what time of day that is. I used to read with my son while we were waiting for the bus to pick him up and take him to school. And he was on the bus from the time he was 3 years old. He was on the bus from the time he was 2 years old to go to school. So we would sit outside and read as we were waiting for the bus. Read in the bathroom, in the bathtub, before you go to bed, but read. And for a few of those minutes, just read. actively involve the children in the reading. That's just, you know, kids can't sit still. And we can do that by asking them questions about the book, having them turn the pages, things like that. Read something you both like. Your enthusiasm is contagious. And that's important. They need to know that reading is fun and it's, excuse me, and it's something. They need to know, back to that print motivation from our early literacy, six early literacy skills, they need to know that there's something really cool inside that book. Right? And usually if I'm doing this with parents, I have books here, all kinds of books, and I'm demonstrating things as we're talking about them. The next one is, oh, and something from your life. So if you're going to take a plane ride, read a book about taking plane rides to prepare the child for it. And then afterwards, read a book about having taken a plane ride and talk about it and their experience. This will both help prepare the child for the plane, and it will also get him where he's at, you know, what he's interested in right now. Use accurate manipulatives and tactile illustrations. Again, our kids can't see the pictures, and if it's just language, it might be boring. If you throw a little music in, that's good too. That's great, but we want to give them that, those, when children, let me back up. When children are learning to read and they're reading picture books, they're getting visual cues from the pictures in the picture books. Our kids aren't getting those cues, so we need to create them in another way. So if you're reading a book about airplanes, make sure you have a toy airplane there, right? In your libraries, if you're reading a book to a group of kids about airplanes, make sure you have enough airplanes for everybody, or pass one around. One of my favorite programs that I do is growing a, it's by Louise Ellert, Growing a Vegetable Garden. And do y'all know that book? Okay. I have it in like 20 different formats. I've got it in a big book format, I've got it in Braille format, I've got it in board book, I've got it in typical format. But before I do that book, if it's going to be a group of kids with disabilities, or kids who are blind with low vision, I go across the street to the greengrocer and I say, I need one potato, one tomato, one, you know, one of everything you can spare, and keep it under $5. So I always get the old fruit and vegetable, or all vegetables, and I go back and I go to pay him, and he always says, oh no, this is the program you do for those kids who are blind, right? And I say, yeah. He says, oh, just take them. We've been playing this game for almost 20 years. But then as these things come up in the book, I'm passing them around. So everybody's holding a vegetable, and when we come to the end, and they can feel it, they can smell it, and it works a lot better than the plastic vegetables. But if you don't have such a great greengrocer, go ahead and use the plastic ones as long as they're accurate. And I'm giving them the support that they would otherwise get from the pictures in the book and helping them understand the book. And for other students, people with our students with intellectual disabilities or with autism spectrum disorder, I'm making the learning concrete. People with learning disabilities, it's going from being abstract to concrete, and that's a really important learning tool too. And then we take around a bucket. At the end, you make vegetable soup. So we've got a big bucket, right? Take it around. If you want to put yours, go ahead, put that in. There you go. Put it in. Who's going to help me stir? Oh. See what happens when you sit in the front row? Help me stir it. Okay. All right. Make a bowl. Okay. I'm going to pour some soup into it, and then you can blow on it and sip it.
Do you have soup?
Nope. Oh. That part's imaginary, which is also good for kids. Get some help. When you're a parent of a child with a disability, you feel very alone. I say this from personal experience and from having worked with families. And sometimes you're the only family in the world that's going through this, or at least you think you are, but you aren't. It's a little easier now with the internet if you're a family that can connect reliably and regularly to the internet. Most of the families that I work with cannot. They're the 30% of people who don't have regular access to the internet at home and come to the library for their internet, or they have it on one cell phone that the entire family shares. Get some help. Go to the agencies. Go to the library, go to Andrew Haskell, our local library, and get some help, because we can't do this on your own. Go to the Adaptive Technology Center. Talk to other parents. We've got some great active parent groups in New York. And that's a really hard message for parents to hear. It's not one our culture supports, particularly not in the Midwest, I think. And it's not one, certainly not one I grew up with. And it's certainly not one that's politically in fashion right now. But frankly, none of us can do this on our own. None of us parents are given a book with instructions on how to raise our children. Though, I have to say, I had Jamie convinced for, I don't know, 3-4 years that I did have a 1,927-page book, invisible, that answered all the questions. And I would pull it out one time and say, why can't I do that? And I said, because on page 27, paragraph 3, it says you can't do that. Okay, so it didn't work for very long, but it blew up. Okay, so get some help. Create literacy-rich environments. And this means different things for different people. For our kids, it means getting a Braille labeler. And we have a Braille labeler at the library. I have trouble getting the tape. So if anybody has a good, reliable source for the tape, I'd really like to hear that. And label everything. The same way that a first-sighted child, you'd write on Post-its on everything, right? Label the toys, label the chairs, label the soup cans, and the little guy at the bottom there, he's exploring environmental print in the form of a, I think that's a can of vegetables with a Braille label on it.
10 minutes.
Karen. 10 minutes, thank you. And then the top picture is two children reading a book using a hand-over-hand model, and it's a Braille book. I'm going to leave you guys to sort out the hand-over-hand method of teaching and how and when to use it and how and when it's ethical. But for some kids who are into it, it helps and it works. I would never force anybody to do it. So, and role models. Again, this is a little harder for our kids because they can't see you reading the newspaper. They can't see you writing the shopping list. So that's where that self-talk comes in and where it needs to go on a little later. And with my son, I used to point out pictures. Okay, I should back up. I am not a morning person. That's my cup of coffee, and it is almost empty. Ooh, good point. Okay, so in the morning, I used to get up. I did the best. I would get something on the table for Jamie, get my coffee, get something on the table for me, and sit and read the paper, ignoring my son. But I would point out the pictures in the paper better when they got color pictures and tell him what was going on about the paper. And I would read him little snippets here and there. We need to do that with our kids. The most commonly read piece of print in this country is a cereal box, by the way. Turns out I'm not the only not morning person. Again, with our kids, they're not going to get that incidental learning, so we need to make it more explicit. If Jamie had more vision issues than he had, I would have been more conscious about reading out loud constantly and describing the pictures in the paper and things like that. So, and making sure that I had Braille books on the table for him, that the little placemats that had all those, you know, those little alphabet placemats and stuff, I would have Brailled those. But making a literacy-rich environment and modeling literacy. So we've had a bunch of volunteers and summer youth employment, and those are teens, underprivileged, in quotes, teens, who are paid by the city to work. So we've had several who are blind in the library, and one of the things that they do is they go into the medical clinics and they read to kids using Braille books. And this is really important because they're modeling reading for the kids there, and that's what the whole program's about. We have a whole program that goes in, does that kind of thing, and I just plug them into it. But it's important, too, for the... we used to make sure... that we took them to the vision clinics in particular so that they could model reading Braille for the parents and the kids. Stephen was one of those volunteers. Stephen was with us for 2 years, 2 summers. He was great. Stephen loved math. This was his thing. And he went to an elite high school in New York, and it was known for math. And he was taking calculus, and it was December before they got his textbook to him, and even then, only the words were brailled, not the equations. All right, that was the last year Stephen studied math, and it still makes me angry. And they gave him a C, they passed him the class, they gave him a C grade, it was a pity grade. He did not earn that C because he didn't have any access to the materials. As hard as we tried, working with the agencies, working with this and that, working with the commission, nobody could get that textbook to him. And that brings me to my next slide. Oop, I think. There we go. Barriers to education. Children with disabilities are entitled to a free, appropriate education from the age of 3 on. By federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act improved. Most states have also opted into early intervention. So young children with disabilities, who are young children, including young children who are blind and with low vision, should be getting services in schools. There's a lot of barriers to the services that they're getting, even when they're getting them. So 10 to 12% of blind children read Braille in school. 50% of blind high school students drop out. And yet, the majority of working blind adults read Braille. Sighted children do not learn to read by being introduced to reading 2 hours a week in a resource room. They learn to read because they get 2 hours of reading instruction every day in school. The recent Supreme Court decision, I think, will in the long run turn this around, because it was very, very clear that under IDEA, children are entitled to more than the minimum education, which is in large part what they often get, particularly in the New York City area. And New York City has some of the best services. So this is something we need to teach parents. That's why it's in here. Because parents have low expectations for their children learning to read. There's a shortage of Braille teachers. And schools always plead education budget. Well, they can't do that because the budget is what they make it. Let's be clear about this. The money's there. It's how they choose to spend it. And there's a bias in the school system now, and this has been true for a long time, towards audio and large print. And that's great for some people, but it's not for everybody. There's also a pressure on parents to normalize. You don't want your child reading Braille. You want them reading large print or audiobooks, right? As an audiobook reader, I think I may have forgotten to say this in the beginning, that I have dyslexia and dysgraphia. And I am primarily an audiobook reader. And I can tell you that there is not enough nonfiction in audio. So it's not a great way to learn, necessarily, those kinds of things. So, but the schools do put that pressure on families to normalize. You don't want them reading all that Braille. It's so bulky. It's so hard to learn. Well, it's no harder to learn than print. Print's hard to learn, too, by the way. But if that's what you're exposed to and that's what you're taught, that's what you learn. It's like saying Chinese is hard to learn, so everybody should learn English. Well, that makes sense if you're an English speaker, but not if you're a Chinese speaker. And then this all culminates in bad IEPs. On the slide, I say poor IEPs because I'm trying to be a little more politically correct. But they're bad, and they exclude our children from learning, and it starts from the time they're in early intervention. Educators say that they make a decision about whether a child will be a Braille reader or a large print reader when they're about four, between the ages of 3.5 and 4.5. They have missed 3.5 and 4.5 years of learning. Right, if they're not exposed to Braille from the time that they're born, from the time they're very young, those critical early literacy years. And that's a message I try and get out to parents. It's not a message that all the schools want to hear, by the way. But it's a really important message for parents to have. If their children are starting kindergarten and they're just being exposed to Braille, if that decision has just been made, they are 5 years behind their peers. Right? That's a gap they'll never make up. No matter how smart they are, no matter how good the schools are. So yes, I teach parents about this, and it's really, really important. There is a cartoon on the bottom here. It's a teacher in front of a class writing on the board. This reminds me of Stephen. This is why it's here. And there's a guy, a student in the last row, by the way, sitting in a row by himself with his guide dog and dark glasses on, and the teacher says, "You at the back, read this homework I've set for you," and he's pointing to what's on the board. It's by Crippen, by the way. He does really great stuff, making fun of the barriers that people with disabilities face. Except this isn't so funny. Whenever Child Ready to Read came out, they had Braille readers, blind students, taking pen and paper tests. Then, in New York State, they Brailled the tests after a couple of years, and the first question on the first test said, "Look at the picture on the cover of this test book," and it was nicely Brailled. And correctly Braille. But it was ridiculous. Okay. So this is what I tell parents, and as librarians, we need to be advocates for this too. So what are the, there are other barriers, additional barriers to reading for parents. Sorry, that slide's not in my notes. Fear of Braille. Parents can't read it. They're afraid of it, right? Inappropriate formats. They have trouble getting the books that they need and the formats that they need. Lack of non-visual cues and expensive books. And I think throughout, we've talked about different ways for them to address this. And that we can help them as librarians address this. By the way, for those of you adult librarians who are looking at me going, but I don't have kids who come in, your patrons have kids. And if they're Braille readers, they need to be using these same formats and these same techniques with their kids, whether or not, whether they're sighted or not, because they need to be sharing literature with them and doing all this modeling. I should have started that in the beginning. Sorry, guys. So there are many ways to read. This is usually the last... No, this is the second last slide. So there are many ways to read, and here I've got pictures of people listening to books while reading Braille, parent and child, a guy reading, father and son reading Braille together. This picture of a large print book, computer-assisted books, and things like that. Then we go on to the resources. About 2 minutes? Yeah. The resources and the ones I give them in the New York area are Andrew Haskell, Seedlings Press, National Braille Press, American Federation of the Blind, the Technology Resource Center, TechWorks, NAPFI, National Associations for Parents of the Visually Impaired, AFB, Include NYC as a local advocacy group, and Braille Reading Pals, which has different iterations in different states and different funders, but it's available free to all kids. So your library... helps every child get ready to read. There's a picture of a read and play program at my library with a librarian reading a book to about 6 seated kids, and then a picture of the main entrance to our library. This is my contact information and the Every Child Ready to Read logo, as well as our library card. Yeah, okay, there you go. I was going through because I've got two more slides to do. What can you do? Those early literacy kits that Jill talked about, Jill and those guys talked about yesterday, built.
We're going to do it right after.
So that you're going to hear about, build them and use them for your families. Do workshops for parents and teachers, by the way, and paraprofessionals. They get no training in any kind of literacy. Partner with your early intervention programs and schools and public libraries and your parent groups. Reach out to your parents who come in and ask about their kids and their kids' literacy and just get the word out. It's the hardest thing in the world to do and also the most important. Here's more of my contact information, cbanks@bklynlibrary.org, 718-253-4948. Otherwise, you get in touch with me through Jill. And I want to, I'm going to leave it on that slide, and I want to tell you a story, and this is from Future Reflections. And it was a story that, no, I'm sorry, Dots for Braille Literacy. And it's a story that played out over many years. And I'm telling you it because I want to remember our children with multiple disabilities. A father of a child who has multiple disability, including blindness and developmental disability, writes in Future Reflections, that he and his son's teachers had given up on his son learning to read Braille when he was 11 years old. The father commented, "I shared my son's sense of relief. I shared the teacher's assessment that Braille literacy was a futile quest for a child as damaged as my son, as mine. Yet, a distant part of me was outraged by the life sentence of illiteracy that was to be imposed upon Kevin." This father overcame his fear of Braille and through trial and error found a method of teaching Kevin. Initially, so even though, quote, he may not read a book, he could understand how others are able to read it, unquote. The father eventually found a sympathetic teacher, aide, and vision teacher. The next installment of the story, Kevin is now 26 at this writing. He is at the Florida Lions Conklin Center for the Multiply Handicapped Blind, studying Braille and enjoying the absence of his parents. He says he's not coming home. He's probably right. He sent us a letter this week, the first we've ever gotten from him. His name, 2 R's in Murphy, the alphabet, 2 G's, no F, and I love you. He knows how to Braille this. His mother's siblings and I can read and write back to him on a Perkins Braille writer. The silly little things I manipulated so long ago, the Braille Cells, his teaching tool, have now led to the greatest literary discourse my world has ever known. The ability to process 300 to 400 words a minute will never be Kevin's. Braille literacy, however, is his forever. And then the final installment. That 13-year-old is today an adult who holds a job and lives in his own apartment, far from me. He nurtures a true love of Braille far beyond his ability to use it, yet none will call him illiterate. His letters bring pleasure somehow different than his telephone calls. Perhaps his pages are colored by memories of the years he worked and by the success of his literacy. The little toy blocks I mutilated so long ago opened a path to a world Kevin might never have known. I wonder at times how much of my love of literacy would have been lost if Kevin could never share it with me. But I know that he has his own. This is what we can help parents do for their kids, to share their worlds and to embrace the birthright that every child has for literacy. Thank you.